can hear my neighbor calling. I can't breathe. And now I'm in a struggle land. I can't leave. Calling out the violence of these racist police. Said we ain't gonna stop until our people are free. Said we ain't gonna stop until our people are free.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I'm your host at Leslie Mack. And I am so excited to announce that I'm joined by my permanent and regular co-host, Ricky L. Hines II. Hey, Ricky, what's going on?
Hey, I'm glad to be for the upgrade or the promotion.
No, it's so awesome having you here, and I'm really excited that you're going to be with me all the time now. If in case this is your first time listening to the show, this is a weekly podcast devoted to supporting citizens working to create a lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. And just to give a quick bio on my co-host, Ricky is a Los Angeles native. He's a U.S. Navy veteran, an avid Googler, a blogger, and he's founder of the Americans United Again movement. He hosts 2 podcasts in addition to this one. He's the host of the Americans United Again podcast, and he's the co-host of the AUA Hope podcast with the lovely Sherelle. How are you doing?
I am great.
And happy new year as well.
Looking forward to doing this.
Yeah, me too. And we have a second guest with us today, which is Davey Celeste. Hey, Davey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing so good. Thank you so much for joining us. Davey is an artist, an educator, and an entrepreneur. She is a high school special education teacher in the D.C. school system, and she is the CEO of a D.C. Tutor LLC, a company that provides student-centered educational services to clients in the Washington, D.C. area. And she's also founder of Free Your Soul and Mind, FYSM, a movement that celebrates creative and independent thinkers. She loves writing and experimenting with music, telling stories, reading young adult novels, and making jewelry. So welcome to the show. So glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad you're having me.
Yeah. Again, in case this is your first time, you can find the show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network. You can also find us on our website, fergusonresponse.org. And if you have actions that are going on in your city or would like to find actions that are going on in the movement, you can find that information on fergusonresponse.tumblr.com. So how was everyone's new year?
Went pretty well. I mean, didn't do too much, but I enjoyed just being able to see a new year, to be honest.
That's true. How about you, Davey? Would you do anything cool in D.C.? What's going on down there?
Actually, I'm not in D.C. right now. I am in Atlanta.
Oh.
Yes, I'm visiting my one of my best friends and also my godson, who turns 1 in 2 days.
Oh, how exciting.
So, yeah, we just had a nice time at home hanging out and playing board games. It was fun.
Very cool. Well, I wanted to start, just since it is the new year, about maybe a few things we all think could be left for the movement in 2014. Is there anything that you're like, oh, can we leave that there? Leave it in the past. What, did you have any thoughts on that, Ricky?
The misogyny within the movement. Mm. I know we talked about it last.
We did,
last week. Mm-hmm. But I feel so bad every time I hear about it. It's just like, guys, come on, really? Is this necessary? That for me is one of the biggest things. I'd like to leave behind maybe some of the trauma without negating some of the drive that it's given a lot of people.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's realistic, but it would be amazing. It would be great to see.
That would be good to see. How about you, Davey? Did you think of anything that might be good to leave in 2014?
Absolutely. I would say division. I think that we can, as we're moving forward, particularly with this movement, find ways that we don't have to agree, but find ways to still stay united even when we don't, when we have varying opinions about how we should move forward. That, and also unsupported opinions. So, you know, not doing your homework enough to really develop, you know, an opinion that could lead to some change.
Those are good ones. Those would be really great to leave behind. I'd like to leave behind troll entertainment. I would like to just leave it in 2014 and just keep your block hand strong and keep it moving. That's what, that would be a good thing to leave in 2014, because they feed off of it, you know? It's just, it's unfortunate. And just to put our energies towards that is just definitely not... not a good thing. And you guys actually hit on two of my other ones, which was misogyny and the division. So, yeah, that's a good, that's a good list to just, let's just leave it behind us and not go into 2015 with any of those things dragging us down. Have you guys heard anything about this pledge of the New Year's Revolution pledge? Did you guys hear anything about it?
I have. I haven't actually gotten around to filling out the pledge, though.
That's okay. It just came out.
Today has, today has been my I'm not doing anything day.
That's a good thing. Except for I roped you into this today. I was like, you can relax right up until I'm ready to record you, in which case, let's do it together. Then no more relaxing, Ricky. Yeah, so actually it just came out today. It's from the great people at Ferguson Action. So they're asking people to take the New Year's Revolution pledge, and they have that on, you can go to engage.fergusonaction.com, and they are calling on us to make 2015 the year of resistance, which is pretty exciting. So I'll read the pledge. It says, I pledge to make 2015 my year of resistance to state violence against Black lives. I challenge myself and those in my community to take risks as we confront the many ways that Black lives are diminished and taken from us. This pledge is in defense of all Black lives. We stand with Black men and women. We act when Black, queer, and trans lives are threatened. We defend the rights of our Black family when we are poor, disabled, and incarcerated. I will elevate their names. I pledge to practice resilience as I make space for direct action and civil disobedience. I will also act for the healing of our communities and make space for my own healing so I may be part of this movement for the long haul. This year, I will declare boldly and loudly through my words and actions that Black lives matter. It's a good pledge. They did a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that most of the people in the movement have been doing a majority of what's stated in the pledge, but it's always nice to have like some concrete expectations for everyone.
Yes.
And I think that that's what it serves as, is, you know, a way of saying, look, I know that we've all been doing this, but we need to continue to do this. And for those things that you may not have been doing, you need to maybe, you know, look at how you can do them in the future.
Absolutely. I love that they kind of tackled a little bit of the misogyny end and just making sure we're inclusive, and also mentioning the self-healing, which I know is something we've talked about on the show a lot, because this is going to be a long haul endeavor for all of us that are involved. So I think that both of those points were really great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm going to have to take that. I'm going to have to take that pledge.
Absolutely. So again, if you're looking to take the pledge, you're hoping to get at least 10,000 signatures on it, you can visit Ferguson Action online. You can go directly to the pledge at engage.fergusonaction.com. So I wanted to jump into talking a little bit about some of the, I don't know, I've just noticed now we're seeing a lot more direct action connected to demands in various local municipalities, and of course specifically related to police brutality and law enforcement accountability. So I thought we could talk a little bit about some of these different things that have been proposed and what we think about them, what analysis do we have as far as research of their effectiveness, how they could and will work in real life. Because I think we're getting to that point where a lot of people are going to have to start making at least some decisions on what they're asking for. And it's best to be as informed as we can be before we start asking for things.
Absolutely.
Because they can be used against us inappropriately. So we want to make sure we're looking at the pitfalls of them. So obviously one that people have been talking about for quite some time, even President Obama talked about this, which is body cams.
Yeah.
What are your guys' thoughts on those?
Well, I will say that I think that it would definitely help to increase accountability. Mm-hmm. However, we have seen with a number of cases in this country, particularly Eric Garner, that body cameras are not the end all, you know, they aren't the solution. They're an aid in helping to, you know, increase accountability within the police system. But I think that, of course, it needs to be coupled with a number of other things. It's interesting, too, because I remember body cams was like huge, this huge proposal until the case or until, you know, the Eric Garner case was brought to the grand jury. And that everybody was like, oh, body cams didn't help in this case.
Sure didn't.
They should have.
Yeah.
So we cannot rely there. Any of these proposed things, yes, they will aid it, but we have to take a look at the entire system. So it's a little portion of it, you know, and even still, you know, I think there was another case most recently where the camera, the dash cam and the body cam were turned off.
Yeah.
So, you know, accountability first, you know, what makes these officers accountable if these cameras are not turned on? You know, what are the consequences for that? You know, so I think there has to be a lot, you know, considered in this, and also not look to these things like the body cam as a solution to the problem, but something that can help us in solving many issues.
Absolutely. Ricky, what about you?
Well, I like the body cameras for the psychological effect more than anything else. Yeah. I mean, as Davey's already pointed out, we've seen with Eric Garner that, you know, if people don't care whether it's on tape or not. If they really want to excuse it, they're going to excuse it anyway. But what it has shown to do is give police officers a different – They basically act differently. The first test case, which was Riverside, California, mm-hmm. the results from that were astounding. When you have an 80% drop in, you know, reports of police violence or police brutality, simply because they have to be cognizant that everything that they're filming is on camera, then it helps hold them accountable. It's one way of holding them accountable. And to some degree, it helps hold people who are who they have interactions with accountable, because there is no lying. There's only so much that you can get around with respect to the story.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. I do think that there's a level, too, back to what Davey was saying, which is that the consequences from the videotape being there have to be significant to have lasting effect on the people being filmed. So it seems to me that without being coupled with consequences coming from being caught on camera doing things, we're missing a vital piece to the punishment, so to speak, or the effect that we want the cameras to have. Because it's not just, oh, you're being video camera, so act differently. It's like you're being video cameraed, and therefore the things that you're doing can be held accountable. You can be held accountable for more concretely later on. And that's the part that I think we need to make sure is still in the discussion. It's not just getting the tape. It's what happens after the tape is viewed and is shown to show negligence, that there are consequences to that negligence. So,
and then I think it's also one of the things that we also making sure that this is an effective proposal is to also point out for the cops that are doing their job, whether it be by the book or, you know, in you know, the best interest of the citizens that they're protecting, that these cameras are also proof of that.
Yep.
So, you know, and so it's not just, oh, we're giving you body cameras because we know you're doing something wrong. You know, we're giving, this is, it goes both ways, right. You know, in a case where, you know, it's this officer's word against this citizen's word, you know, it goes both ways. And I think that that's also something that needs to be like emphasized, because, you know, it does kind of look like this, okay, we're doing this because you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. There are a number of people who aren't, but there are also a number of people who are. So making sure that it's very clear that this is not an attack on your own, you know, personal rights as a police officer, yada, yada. No, this is specific. This is helping everybody in the process.
Absolutely. And, you know, law enforcement in this country has been for years putting up CCT, is that what it is? Style cameras all over major metropolitan cities so they can watch what's going on in traffic, so they can watch what's going on in different areas. It seems to me that they've already signed on to the notion that having video is a good thing. They've already agreed and already systematically and put in implementation programs that support that notion. So it just doesn't, I don't really see much of a pushback, with the exception of budget in some cases. But it really, in terms of logistics, it's hard to see where they have a leg to stand on with coming up against it. But I do think enforcement's going to be critical. And again, having mechanisms so that it's not at the choice of the police officer when something's on or off.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
I think the biggest thing with respect to holding police accountable for what's caught on video has to do with it's more so of a local issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because like the Eric Garner case, if that district attorney thought that it would hurt him politically to not bring that case to trial, there's no way in hell he would have that there wouldn't have been an indictment.
Right.
Especially with him now mulling over a Senate campaign. Or,
right.
I'm sorry, a House campaign.
Right.
It's no secret that part of the accountability has to come in people's conscience. You know, watching someone die on tape shouldn't just be, you know, conflict porn. It should be a call to action. This isn't right.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Which brings us to the next suggestion that's out there. And I know it's one that's been talked about a lot here in Philadelphia, which is independent review boards and special prosecutors. So I know here in Philadelphia, the idea is to have an independent review board, potentially elected, potentially not. Maybe there's some discussion as to how that would shake out here. But the big pieces are ability to subpoena, ability to bring charges, and ability to assign a special prosecutor, being at the discretion of the review board. There is a civilian review board here, but it has zero power whatsoever right now, the way that it stands. So the idea is to have one that actually has some teeth and ability to do something, and have it written that anytime an officer discharges their weapon or their interaction results in a death, that the review board has to review it.
Mm.
So those are the main points of the local one here in Philadelphia. I don't know about other ones, but I knew that those are the big points from this one. How do you see that shaking out? I think it takes a little bit of that political pressure off when you have some independent options and also a special prosecutor who would be coming from outside of the jurisdiction in most cases. What are your thoughts on that?
I really like that particular proposal. Mainly because there's too much of a conflict of interest within the system, and you know, involving some individuals who are separated from it, who you know don't, you know, political gain is not, you know, a priority. And I mean, of course, it's not going to be the case for everybody, but less of an opportunity for that to happen. It, you know, I think that it, you know, removing it from the actual system would be really, really beneficial. So I think it would work very, and the idea that if they discharge the weapon, they have to, you know, see this board that's separate from, you know, that isn't their boss,
right,
that they're friends with, or, you know, that they know that if they make, you know, if this goes to trial, that this will look bad for this. Like, we're not worried about that. We're worried about justice and actually protecting and serving the people,
right,
rather than our political interests. I think that could really, really help, to kind of remove the political nature of it and really get down to the actual issues when something like this happens.
I agree. I think there's the thing is that even with the civilian review, even with a civilian review board, there's still a political element because you have to look at who who's on the board, how they got there. So in addition, if we're going to have an independent review board, we need to also be looking at ways to galvanize people to vote in those types of elections.
Right.
because those elections have power. You may not think that you have much power in a presidential election, although that's not entirely true, but you know, I could understand why you might think that. But in a situation where it's your local city and it's an independent review board that may very well save or bring justice for you or your family, it makes sense to, and it makes sense to push people out to do those types of things and be able to hold that review board accountable. Because at the end of the day, someone still has to hold them accountable, and it has to be the people.
Yeah, and I think that that would actually be something that you could get people to the polls for. It's tangible. It means something to them specifically. And it's an issue that everybody can relate to, and especially people that don't normally think that their vote means much. Because a lot of these things will come down to very small numbers of voters in terms of who wins and who doesn't in those kinds of scenarios, which we see with a lot of those local elections.
Absolutely.
So I know another thing that is on a lot of local demands is specific policy changes, things like ending stop and frisk, broken window policing coming to an end, drug law adjustments and changes, which happened here in Philadelphia this past year. Possession of small amounts of marijuana went down to a misdemeanor, so you just get a ticket and no longer arrested. What are you guys' thoughts on that? Can that really make a difference here? I think it's interesting to put a little coverlet on this in the current work stoppage by the New York Police Department, which has led to a drop. I think it's a 98% of non-violent or misdemeanor and tickets, basically, and 66% lower in all arrests, generally speaking.
The way it breaks down is from December 22nd of 2013 to the end of the year, and December 22nd of 2014, the criminal court summonses were down 94%, traffic violations down 94%, parking violations down 92%, and as you said, Leslie, overall arrests are down 66%. Can we just continue this? Can this just like? Can we continue to hurt police officers' feelings to the point where they actually do the job that everyone expects them to do, not to fuck with people?
Yeah.
Like, the first thing that I heard, or the first thing that I thought when I read this was, so you're literally threatening people with a good time.
I think I read a quote where they said, they're only arresting people when they absolutely have to. Isn't that what you're supposed to have already been doing?
Oh my God.
When did that not become the policy? I must have missed it.
Thanks, guys.
They're arresting people where there's a physical victim attached to it.
Oh, so nice. So nice of them.
But they're. Yeah. This goes to that they're actually what they're trying to do is get revenue down, which will force de Blasio to have to raise taxes and subsequently undermine him politically in the city. That's their real goal.
But that's fine. I'd gladly pay extra taxes to know that I'm not going to be pulled over unnecessarily.
What they failed to remember is that he was voted in. 78% agreed with his reform of the police department platform. That's pretty high. So people have already kind of said they're okay with whatever has to get done here. Yeah. It's baffling to me.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing, too, is they're kind of biting themselves in the ass, because in the event that people don't want their taxes raised, guess what that means? Layoffs.
Yep.
I mean, great. Continue to do your job. Do your job the way that you've been doing it since December 22nd. We very much appreciate that. I wish the LAPD would do the exact same fucking thing. However, you guys need to back the mayor up when he says, look, we need to raise taxes, because the reality is that if they don't, doing what you're doing, you're going to get laid off. So everyone's happy. You guys get to keep your jobs. People get arrested and hassled less. And people get what they expect.
Absolutely.
From the police.
And I think those policy changes like ending stop and frisk, it does two things in my mind. One, stops a lot of these interactions that escalate unnecessarily. That's the first thing it does, which is huge. It doesn't speak to the root cause of those interactions, but it just literally takes the number of them down, which is better for everybody. And then secondly, I think to the the communities that are trying to interact with these police officers, it gives them a level of, well, maybe we can start to trust them again, because the atmosphere right now is complete distrust, and rightfully so. And I don't understand how police departments and law enforcement in general don't see that their treatment of these communities is why the relationship is so bad. It's like an abuser. You know, I don't know why we can't get along. Well, you keep hitting me. So that's why we can't get along. Yeah. We're not going to get along. So this is what I don't understand. And so I think a lot of those policy changes speak to those kinds of issues, which I think are good. I don't think they're wholesale. And as I said, I don't think they go to the root cause of these things when you have a police officer describing an 8-year-old boy like a demon. I mean, this is not stuff you're going to get rid of by ending Stop and Frisk. But again, I think that the numbers will show that it will decrease the number of these altercations and hopefully decrease the number of deaths as well.
And it's also, you know, with Stop and Frisk, especially considering as disproportionate as it is to who gets stopped and who doesn't get stopped, of course, it only contributes to the you know, superhuman demon, you know, persona that is given to a lot of black people in this country. So with, you know, Stop and Frisk, you know, assessing it and eliminating it to some degree, because, you know, there is this belief that, oh, if you're not doing anything wrong, you won't get stopped. And so it continues to kind of perpetuate the stereotype that, you know, that we're more dangerous. That's why we're getting stopped. So hopefully, even though it doesn't, you know, it doesn't eliminate the, you know, the foundation of those things, at least it you know, helps, you know, in kind of not necessarily reversing that, but helping people to see it from a different place or a different view.
Right. So.
Yeah, I think it becomes less of a self-fulfilling prophecy because, mm-hmm. you know, you're not forcing cops to stop people as often, and particularly people of color. So it's, you know, at some point you hope that that would be common sense to people, but it's not, because they don't understand that the reality that they have with their interactions with the police and the reality that people of color, particularly black people, have with the police are completely different.
So different.
There's no real parallel. And so it's mind blowing for them to believe that, you know, hey, the cops are out here beating up Negroes like hotcakes. Like it's,
you know, just the fact that you said that. I saw Selma today. And watching it, every scene, because I watched it with one of my best friends, and the two of us were sitting there, like, I swear, saying 2014 every other scene. Mm-hmm. You know, that there were so many things that were happening then that are happening now, and so many of the counter arguments that King was providing, you know, in the movie and to LBJ was just like, whoa, this is happening, right? It hurt even more because of the time that we're in and because of the things that are happening right now. And so there, you know, I don't know, have either one of you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet. It hasn't come here yet. We're not one of the select cities.
Got it. Well,
no, I haven't gotten around to seeing it either. But I think that's something that's happened throughout history, though. Yeah. When you look at abolitionists, you know, the argument was that black people wouldn't know what to do if they were free. The fuck? Like, you know, they
we would be free.
What do you mean?
What do you do? Yeah, what do you do with it exactly?
Yeah, I mean, it's always that's a very conservative minded defense of things, is that I don't want things to change, so whatever seems like it's might be plausible in my head is a reason to stop doing it or just to deny it. And I don't mean that as like a conservative political ideology, although that's pretty similar.
Pretty similar, yeah.
Yeah, I just mean that literally that's how you can serve a system that you are in favor of. You sit on it. You defend it at any possible cost. That's the way the tobacco industry did with cigarettes for decades.
Yep.
Cigarettes aren't harmful. Cigarettes aren't harmful. Even though internal emails showed that they knew the exact opposite.
Right.
Exactly. And then that's the thing, you know, as we continue to look at the system, we're asking a number number of people, the majority in this country, to dismantle a program that many, or a system that many of them have benefited from for centuries. So, you know, it's not something that will happen overnight. It's not something that will, and I think that's been probably one of the greatest challenges, or that I've seen specifically, you know, is coming to terms with the fact that the type of change that we want to see will not happen as quickly as we would like it to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, then looking back into history and being like, I know we've gotten far, but at the same time, too many of the things that are happening right now mirror the things that have happened from the past. So I'm not sure exactly how far I've come, you know?
Yeah. And I think that that's why the police brutality piece is so critical to the movement, because the things we're talking about are very concrete, they're very measurable, and they're very obvious. Okay. People like to pretend that they aren't, but that's not true. Of all the things that we have to combat in the movement, I would say that, not to say it's the lowest hanging fruit, but it's the easiest to define. Yeah. When we talk about the larger issues at the heart of the movement, which is, as Ricky just mentioned, this complete disconnect between the Black experience in this country, not just with police, but everywhere, and the white one, you're talking about, you know, cultural shift, not one that has to do with policy and procedure. So that's why I'm really big on making sure we do get these concrete things down, because they will go a long way to helping us have the rest of this conversation at the same time. It's kind of impossible to talk about the other things when you have a police chief or representative on the television calling a 12-year-old boy a man. You can't have the other part of that conversation, because the stuff that's out there has such vitriol attached to them, and we're seen as so subhuman in some circles, that we have to kind of cut that out, because these people are in positions of authority, whether we want to admit that or whether that's good or bad or not. Law enforcement, our justice system, they're held highly in regard in this country, and they always have been. So it's important that we address that, because this is a systemic issue that has bodies attached to it on one end, and on the other end, we can't really move forward without addressing them first. Yeah. So it's really, really critical. And it actually put me in mind, I don't know if you guys have listened to the podcast Serial. Ricky, have you been listening to that at all?
I haven't.
Oh, okay.
I keep hearing good things about it, but
it's decent.
It's
decent.
Stuff that I listened to already.
Yeah, I know you probably are stacked. It's good. It just ended last week, but it's about a case that happened in the Baltimore area. And the main witness in the case is a Black male, and the victim is Korean American, and the person that was convicted of the crime is Muslim. And the entire crux of the case is on the testimony of the Black individual. His name is Jay. And the producer of the story, a white woman, Sarah Koenig, she's from This American Life, has this she sets up the scenario where Jay has said that the reason why he went along with disposing of the body and all this other stuff was because the person who he says killed the girl threatened him with going to the police about some illegal activity. He had been dealing drugs out of his grandmother's house, you know, pretty significant amounts of pot only, but he was dealing drugs. And she dismisses the idea that he would be so frightened of interacting with the law enforcement arm and the police in general, that he would go along with disposing of this body that he had nothing to do with. She dismisses it. Why would anybody be like that? If you didn't do it, why would you think that all you were doing was selling pot? It's not a big deal.
And, you know, and that is so interesting to me, because it's like you don't, and I guess you would have to know that so many people have been put away for doing less.
Yeah. And if you hear from Jay's perspective, he's like, I was doing it out of my grandmother's house. I was afraid she would get pulled into this. I was putting my family at risk. I was really scared. I really did not want to interact with the police at all. And she couldn't, this producer, she's an investigative journalist. She's worked in Baltimore. You know, she did investigative journalism there in the newspapers. And she couldn't fathom the concept that this person would actually have that level of fear when it comes to law enforcement. So it's crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about it, it's right there in front of them. They just don't notice it.
Yeah.
If you look at the Eric Garner video, the first thing that he says in the video is, look, I'm tired of y'all messing with me. Yep. Y'all always are over here messing with me about selling loose cigarettes. And yes, he did have a record of selling them, which I just want to point out isn't the most profitable or lucrative business. So clearly, if you're doing that, you're pretty right. down on your luck.
He didn't steal the cigarettes to sell them. Let's just keep that straight, too. He didn't steal the cigarettes to sell them. He just stole them and is selling them open. It's taxes that are lost here, not any income related to the cigarettes in general.
Yeah, and I mean, there's that too. And you look at it, and this was in an instance where he had just got done breaking up a fight. He's already irritated. He told them straight out, "I'm tired of this. This stops now." And you know, now he's laying dead because he stopped because he no longer wanted to be harassed.
Nope.
It just goes to show you, and it's, you know, to watch the coverage after these gentlemen were killed, were murdered, you know, the amount of character assassination that happened over a man that was selling single cigarettes, you know, it really does speak to the misunderstanding of the human experience as it relates in this country, that we are not a part of the human experience, that we are the less than human experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because only then can you justify somebody's death because they were selling single cigarettes.
Right. Well, it's this just world fallacy. It's this just world fallacy that they have because they can't understand. Because it could never happen to them, it couldn't happen to other people. It's a complete false sense that they have of the world because it's not their world. But unlike us, they haven't been forced to think outside of themselves because we live in their world all the time. So we're always thinking, well, how would this affect a white person? How does this affect me? How do I have to act in this situation? They're never put in that position to have to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, a lot of the conversations that I've had with friends and even associates, I've really encouraged them. A lot of times, you know, when I want to, you know, argue in a situation, I'll just slip an article on their, you know, on their social media timeline or something like that, because I realize that a lot of this is ignorance. It's a lot of it is a lack of knowledge, and some of it is knowing ignorance. And, you know, and I know this is happening, but I choose to ignore it because that's more convenient for me.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are a lot of people who just don't know. When you grow up in a country where your history, the history of your people, is being completely watered down within the, you know, people don't understand. People do not have an understanding of different cultures, you know? And so anybody that doesn't look like them, you know, it's easy to other them and to, you know, to, so, you know, that I think that's, it's such a big part, you know, that lack of knowing is such a big part of this problem. You know, it baffles me. Some of the, excuses that have been made, you know, for these officers,
And I mean, the other thing too is it's not just that it's whatever justifies the incident happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
it doesn't even have to be that we're subhuman. In some cases, it's that we're superhuman.
Right.
And so when you look at Mike Brown, again, he had to be magical. He would have to, like, literally for that story to be true, he would have to be magic.
Well, yeah, he would have. I mean, it would have been.
Or at least an X-Men.
X-Men. Yes, yes.
Matrix, dodging bullets.
Oh, yeah.
Running through bullets. You know, and yeah. It's.
And that's.
And also, I think it's interesting, too, that there's no common sense applied. It's like, we're so stupid we would do all of these things that make no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Like the police are there, and I know that police are pretty fine with killing black people indiscriminately with no consequence whatsoever. But I'm just going to pull a gun on them and just because, just because that makes fire. Sense. Because that makes a
Who
ton of
sense.
Pulls
a gun on a cop and doesn't shoot?
I just don't even know how many people pull guns on cops, generally speaking.
Generally, I mean, that's also true.
For real, I really just, I, that's not something rule. That, as a general rule, it's not something that most criminals are keen to do. They try to avoid the police, too. FYI. I don't even understand the concept of it. I mean,
you
get into those situations when people are caught in the act of a crime, generally speaking. Not just, you know, with their girlfriend at a gas station. Just saying.
Yeah,
not normal.
I mean, no one, like, if you're stupid enough, if you're stupid or bold enough to pull a gun on a cop, who doesn't pull the trigger at least once? There's no one. I've yet to meet that person.
Well, let's keep going on these solutions to the police brutality end of things, which the next one was demilitarization. There's the Stop Militarization Enforcement Act of 2014, which actually was killed and then got revived. And I think it's hopefully going back into committee, I think, is where it stands right now. And so this is kind of to stop the flow of equipment, vehicles, firearms and such from the military to our local police departments, which was put in place with the Patriot Act, of course, because Lord knows we need Bearcats or whatever those things are in Vermont. Yeah. So what do you think about that, Ricky?
I applaud it. I think that at this point,
it's too late, huh?
It's not that it's too late. I mean, you can pull some of that stuff from those departments. And I get that after 9/11, we thought that police law enforcement agencies might need them for reasons, but those reasons haven't happened and we can scale back. You know, it's not that difficult. This is a society. Everything that we do, we make up. We make up the rules. We can change the rules. Mm-hmm. Guess what? We don't need them anymore. We just find a way to get rid of them.
Yeah, can we start wearing our shoes on planes again?
Yeah, I would.
While
I would
we're at it, that'd be good.
Yeah, at an airport. Mm-hmm. I don't want to
take my shoes off. It's not fun.
Yeah,
we'll see. We'll see what happens with this one. I do think there's a level of, I don't think they're going to give back most of the equipment that they have. But this speaks to kind of, as we see the protest spreading and getting larger and more widespread, which is what I think the trend is, this goes to kind of keeping things on an even keel, because you see in Ferguson, you've seen in lots of cities, Berkeley, all over the place, Berkeley, Missouri, just this past week, and St. Louis just yesterday, that the force that they're able to come at peaceful protesters, I don't even know what to say about it. It's so disturbing, and I don't understand how every citizen in this country isn't appalled. At people just simply exercising their right to demonstrate being met with this kind of force. And this is where I have a hard time thinking that it's ignorance, because you don't see people getting tear gassed for sitting on the ground and think that that's normal, unless you honestly think that they don't deserve any better than that. I don't understand it.
You have to actually see them as people.
Yes.
That's
the problem, you know? Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw this, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, I guess some postcards that were sold of like lynchings that were, you know, that had been sold at, you know, they would take pictures at the lynchings and they would sell the postcards.
Yep.
And somebody, you know, it said, what happened to these people? They had children. That's what happened to them. They had children.
Yep. I mean, some of those pictures, there's children in the pictures.
Yeah. So, and some of those children are still grown up, and maybe some of them have seen other ways or what have you. But the likelihood of that, you grow up in this all your life thinking this, and this person is inferior to me, and that's what you've been taught all your life, you know, and may even have very little, you know, experience or exposure to anybody but the people who are telling you that.
Yep.
You know, that is a part of a significant problem. So that to me still falls under ignorance, you know, because, you know, somebody's beaten that into you all of your life. You know, who are you, who, you know, what would make you question it, you know,
true.
Necessarily. So, you know, just looking at that, you know, that's like you said, they would have to see you as human, and they would also have to see that as a threat to their own personal liberties.
Hmm.
Well, I think that has that last part has to do with framing with respect to the media, because if Eric Garner's murder had been framed as unarmed citizen choked to death in the streets of New York, and before you saw any picture of him, before you saw anything, everything was framed as if he was I hate to say it this way, a white person, because it's the only way that they understand, because they see themselves as the default.
Yeah.
And so if you just frame it without any race initially and then show, oh, well, look, guess what? Guess what this happened to this time? You know, I think that it goes toward helping, because that fear is there first.
Mm-hmm.
The fear that we experience when we see these types of things, they don't see because they don't perceive it being able to happen to them. But when you frame it in a way where it seems very likely to happen to them, because the reality is, more than half of the people who suffer from police shootings are white people. I mean, it's still a disproportionate amount compared to their makeup within the population, but still more than half is a pretty disturbing number.
Yep. Absolutely. And you're right that definitely is part of it. They do have to see us as human for that. The next piece is another legislative piece, which is the End Racial Profiling Act, ERPA. Ricky, have you read much about that act?
I haven't. Normally I'm on top of stuff like that. Let me take a look.
Yeah, well, this one, it serves to, if passed, would ban discriminatory profiling by law enforcement at all levels. It provides provisions for data collecting and monitoring. It includes enhanced and funded training on racial profiling and provides sanctions and remedies for violation of the law. So it speaks to specific acts that would be put in place if passed. I don't know if it will pass. It doesn't look.
Yeah. I mean, I like the concept. I think the devil's in the details.
Of course.
But those, much of it is about ending anything, is really about providing incentives for it to happen, both positive and negative.
Yep.
If there is an instance of where a police department is able to cut down on the amount of racial profiling that they do, they should be rewarded for it. I mean, yeah, you have to reward. It's a shame that you have to reward people for doing the right thing, but that's life. Sometimes you have to do that. And that's a lot more productive than not rewarding them and it not happening.
Sure. And there is both a risk and reward portion to it, because they are able, they would get cut out of specific grant applications and programs that the federal government provides money to local municipalities if they didn't meet these minimum requirements that would be set by the law. So that's kind of the idea of it. And then it does give some additional teeth to using racial profiling, which is something we've seen in law previously. Sexual harassment is a good example of that, where it used to be something that you couldn't prosecute on or charge against your boss, and now you can, etc. So that it's kind of taking it in that direction. I think it's a good law, and we'll see what happens with that one. And then the last one is, which I think is a little less hard or a little harder to measure, which is representative police force and intentional officer training. So this speaks to having the police force demographically mirror the community that it's policing, and then also having intentional officer training that would speak to racial sensitivity and increasing tolerance on the part of law enforcement.
I guess, you know, as I'm listening to this and really kind of taking it in, it's like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. I just, of course, you know, I'm thinking, I don't know why we still need this, but we shouldn't. But also, you know, the fact that we have to put these types of things into law is like, why is this still a thing? And I know that sounds, you know, of course, everybody's thinking that, but at the same time, that the fact that we have to integrate this into our laws in 2015, I don't know.
It is kind of crazy.
You know.
It is and it isn't. Mm. I think that we forget that as as a minority within a democracy, and I don't mean just as a racial minority, I mean as a minority, period, within a structural form of a democracy, you're going to have to fight for your rights. There's never going to be a time where you can just relax and not work to keep to codify these types of things into law, because when you're the minority, you don't get seen as the default. You are seen as the other, and that's irregardless of what type of minority you are. Unless you have a majority of the power, then you're going to have to fight for your rights, and sometimes you have to fight to have them codified in the law.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This actually reminds me, I'm by faith a Unitarian Universalist, and it's a multi-religious faith, so you can come with any religion that you already might have grown up with. So there's Jewish and Catholic and Episcopal and atheist and all sorts of people in it. And our religion is ruled by seven principles. So I'll read a couple of them because they kind of speak to an issue that I had. Our first principle, which is the most important one, is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Principle number two is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And then our seventh principle is respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Okay, there's a bunch of others in there that talk about democracy and peace and all this other stuff. But if you look on the surface of those three principles, you would think that equality with regard to race would be a pretty big deal within a faith that held these three things as one of the seven things that the faith is made up of. You would think that.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the case at all. And I have had a lot of issues within the faith and have been having lots of discussions. I kind of formed a fringe group that we're sort of acting like a political action committee to make change within the faith. And we felt the need to put as one of our goals, this group that I have, to add an eighth principle. And the eighth principle would be, we, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying towards spiritual wholeness by building a diverse, multicultural, beloved community that accountably dismantles racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions.
Mm.
So I see exactly what Ricky's talking about, which is that you would have thought that everything was covered in those seven things. I mean, you would really think everything's covered in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. You would think
right.
that. But
right.
in reality, in practice, it's not. And you do have to sometimes go back and spell these things out so that it's concrete what we mean and what we're looking for.
Right. And I think that also, you know, it's the reason why we need Black Lives Matter in the, you know, when people are saying all lives matter.
Right.
It's the reason why we need it. You know, we, our voices do get, you know, when we're all together, our voices get silenced, you know, and, you know, sometimes, and a lot of the time. And so, you know, it's true that, of course, we do have to, make sure that we are advocating, for the things that we need, you know, in a world where we are not the majority. So it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and get into Davey's area of expertise as well. And this is something that came to me. I've been wanting to talk about it with people for a while, but really has been kind of starting to stir a little bit more in me as the more I interact with my nieces on the subject of the movement and everything that's been going on. I imagine it's sort of a tumultuous time to be coming of age. And looking at the strife in the world and conflict that's going on. And I know how emotionally difficult the last year was for me. I can only imagine a teenager or a tween or, you know, just a child taking all of that in as well must be. Have you seen a lot of effects of this in your work and kind of how have you been addressing it?
Absolutely. You know, to kind of give you a little bit of background, a couple of years or so, you know, 2012, after the Trayvon Martin verdict, it was the summertime. So I was in school, and I have to admit that I felt it was very selfish, the way that I was thinking. I was so thankful that I did not have to come back, that I didn't have to get up the next morning and face my class,
mm-hmm.
because I did not know what I was going to say. you know, what, you know, and that's, I guess, really what kind, when it hit me that I needed to think about how I wanted to empower my students, further in helping them to cope with, because I cannot imagine, being a high school student and, you know, sifting through all of this. I will say in the school that I'm in right now, I really appreciate the fact that the administration has embraced the fact that the issue of Ferguson, the issue of just Black lives and all of it, matter, and that we need to discuss it. So it's discussed in classrooms. I think we've done an assembly about it. We've been involved with the protests in the area, really giving students an outlet. We're a very multicultural school, and you know, that we pride ourselves in serving students all over the city. And so as a result of that, of course, you know, they all have different needs and we have to find ways to address them. So I have seen some of the anxiety, first from students, you know, but I think that, we're a couple years in, you know, of it hitting them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, Trayvon Martin was a big case in, you know, for students kind of, you know, this age, high school age students in particular, those are the ones that I work with, to understand, younger and middle school, some of them, a lot of them were exposed to it then as well. So I think that I've seen the anxiety. I think that what's even more is the trying to address the disdain that they may feel for police or how the police treat them in their own neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and how they feel about that and what that means and the anger. I think the anger is probably the part that is the hardest to address, but I think some of the best ways is to allow students the space not only to discuss it, the space to come up with ways that they would like to participate in the movement, and also to give them knowledge, because again, you know, you look at most of the African American history as it's taught, or the history of cultures, of non-white cultures in this country, and how they're taught in schools. And it is always the, you know, very watered down, you know, basic versions. And unfortunately, even, you know, students whose cultures are being discussed, they're disconnected from their history. So, you know, encouraging them to continue to research and to continue to, you know, to kind of build that gap or build a bridge from where they are to their history and what brought them there, is, I think, part of the, you know, that knowledge is so important, especially when you're talking to somebody about the civil rights movement, or you're talking to them about what has kind of brought us here and how far we've gotten, the strides we've made, and the things that we really think should be further along. They have to understand where they're coming from. And I think that part right there is what one of the ways in which kids can, or students can become more involved is to do their research, you know, to learn more about where they come from, you know, because their history is American history.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know?
I was struck, and this kind of started, I've been talking with my niece, she's 15 and she's in high school. And so I, you know, she's been interested in what I've been doing and kind of what's been going on. She has a cell phone and she's on Facebook and all of that stuff. So it's been easy for us to kind of stay in touch and talk about these things. But at Thanksgiving, we participated in the Stolen Lives Initiative, where you took a picture of an empty seat at your Thanksgiving table and kind of posted it online. Mm. And so, we did that exercise, and as we were at dinner, started talking about why we were doing it and what it was about. And, you know, I didn't want to be inappropriate, but I also wanted to be really upfront about it, because it's very serious. You know, she He certainly looks like an adult to any police officer. And, you know, I just wanted to make sure that there was a space for her to talk about these things. And she got really emotional about it when we started talking about why we were doing it and, you know, what's been going on. And it was very clear that it had been, you know, something that she'd been thinking about a lot. And so it was eye-opening for me to make sure I continued to make that space for her to talk about it and give her some room to do some things. So she's been doing all sorts of stuff. It's been unbelievable. It almost was like she just wanted permission to do something. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it was almost, she was waiting for somebody to say, yeah, go ahead, do something, you know? And so she videotaped my whole family doing the I Can't Breathe challenge over the holiday. She planned out who was going to sing which parts and taped it and then edited it and produced it and did everything with it, which was great. And then she wrote this amazing poem as part of her, she had to do a winter break project, and this is what she did for her project, was to write a poem. She's into music and is a musician, so she related it to lyrics from different songs. I mean, just all of this kind of stuff. So it's been really amazing to see. And I also have been seeing a lot of children at protests and actions, which is great also. I think it's great for their parents and communities to involve them and to see what's been going on and involve themselves. What do you think, Ricky, about kids and teenagers and kind of their role, not just in the movement, but I almost think in the psyche of it? I find it to be a little bit of self-care, because me talking to her about it sort of helped me as well. I was able to process on a different level because I was not talking with, I would say, a peer that I am usually trying to, you know, get information from and that sort of thing. It was a much more emotional conversation with her than I usually have about the movement and the issues surrounding it.
I really don't know. I'm not around as many kids as I used to be. I'm like the oldest of five kids, and my youngest brother is 17, and me and my mom have kind of personally taken to having those conversations with them for years now. My stepfather is Nigerian, so he has a bit of understanding about being black in America, but it's not the same thing.
Right.
He didn't grow up with the same history that like my mother and my grandparents grew up with. And so I think that makes a very tangible difference. And I'm glad that we were able to at least talk to my youngest brother, because as a child, I didn't get much of the things that were going on around me. Sean Bell, Amadou Diallo. Like, when those things happened, I was 16, 17, and I was angry. Mm. And I didn't know what to be angry about. I didn't know who to be angry at. And, you know, at that time, my parents didn't really have as much time to talk to me about those things, but I'm glad that at least with my youngest brother, he's able to process those things. And he at least gets it, even though he lives in an area where he doesn't have to deal with it as much, because he's in a more affluent area now than I was at his age.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I think this, thanks for taking the time just to talk a little bit about that, because I've been thinking about it, and I hope that we'll see a lot more of the different organizations that are planning actions and putting together different things, thinking about how they can involve the youth, and because I think that education is going to be a huge piece of the puzzle as well, to address the larger issues at the heart of the movement and what we're looking to accomplish. In terms of, for lack of a better way of saying this, but truly a once and for all ensuring that Black Lives Matter. It's going to be a full court press on so many fronts, and education is a big piece of that. Another piece, also in Davey's wheelhouse, is arts in the movement, which is something that I've been thinking about as we head into the new year, and different ways in which to express ourselves and make our cause known to more and more people. I think that the arts are going to be really critical in 2015 in making that happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've seen some amazing, absolutely amazing things that have come out of the arts communities, in response to everything that's going on. So, of course, particularly Ferguson. And, you know, I the impact that it's had on me and it's had on the world already. You know, I really do see a lot happening in 2015 as a result of, you know, just people. I see a lot of forward movement, and I see a lot of it as, you know, being kind of spearheaded by the arts, you know, by the artist communities. There's a piece in particular, I don't know if you've seen, it's called New Age of Slavery.
Hmm.
And if you take a look at it, it's actually done by Patrick Campbell, which I have to shout out because he's a graduate of Duke Ellington School of the Arts, which is where I went and also where I taught for a while.
Oh, I have seen this. Yes, it's The Flag, correct?
Yes.
Yes, I have seen it.
So there's a remarkable story behind. He has a remarkable story. And this is just to kind of shout that out a little bit. But he did the piece, you know, in response, I believe, to Ferguson. And when he finished it, he stepped back and just broke down. Like, it's saying, you know, like, what have I done? You know, it's just to, you know, to have created something like this. He said his pieces don't normally do that to him, but this one in particular did. You know, and I hope that, you know, if you get a chance to take a look, there's a great story done on the griot about Patrick Campbell.
Yeah, I'll be sure to link that in the show notes, everyone, for everyone listening. I'll make sure you have that.
Yeah, absolutely. He has a great story. He overcame a stroke that left his right side, you know, paralyzed for, I guess, for a while. And he started learning how to draw with his left hand. And he has this remarkable story. So, but you know, I've seen and it's gone viral. There's just so many different things. I've seen a lot of different artists, musicians. Come out with different pieces, different songs, and you know, bodies of work as a result. I know D'Angelo just recently released Black Messiah early in response to a lot of what's going on. Garner, you know, Michael Brown, Crawford. There's so many names, but yeah, we need these movements because we need people to see a lot of what we're experiencing and a lot of this struggle in different ways. You know, to hear about it in a news article is different from to see it in a piece like The New Age of Slavery, or to hear it in a piece like J. Cole's Be Free. Mm-hmm. To hear the emotion in that, you know, to make it, you know, I think sometimes it takes the arts in order to make an experience human, you know. So I think that, you know, we artists have in, you know, historically driven many of these types of movements, and they're already playing an integral role, but I have a feeling that they're going to continue to, and that they're going to continue to also encourage the significant changes that we need here.
Absolutely. And I think it also speaks to, which is something we've been talking about the past couple of weeks, which is obviously when you're doing civil disobedience, you want to always be upping the ante and kind of pushing things further as you go along, because the idea is that you're holding out until you get what you want. So we want to continue to do that. And I really feel so strongly that huge statements that can be made through the arts are going to be integral to ratcheting things up a bit, you know, because with art, we're able to put things in a perspective and a framing that is very in your face without, you know, necessarily being in the middle of a highway. It still gets that same point across in terms of the visceralness of it, the inconvenience of someone having to look at it or interact with it or see it or hear it or whatever it might be. I think it's really critical. What are your thoughts on, you know, kind of this artistic area of the movement being developed more? Because it's one of my hopes for 2015. Ricky?
Me personally, I like that even before this movement kicked off with Mike Brown's killing, that you saw a steady stream of independent artists continuing to bring up race and to talk about race. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Black lives do matter even before that became a slogan, because there's some things that just say, like, dear white people couldn't have come at a more perfect time. And there's no way that anyone could have planned that by August.
Nope.
You know, and then all of the media hype behind it, like the racism insurance
right.
Commercial or skit that my brother was in, the other skit with the black male PR firm.
Right.
you know, we've had. I gravitate towards comedy,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen a lot of good comedy that's done what good comedians do, which is tell the truth but make you laugh at the same time.
Absolutely.
That is one of the few things that comedians can do nowadays is still be able to tell the truth and get away with it.
Right. Yeah, I saw a thing. I think it was J.L. Colvin that did this, and it was a video of TV anti-heroes if they had been black, and it was like The Shield, The Sopranos, and Breaking Bad. There might have been a fourth one, but basically the show starts and they do what these characters would do, these anti-heroes, and they get killed instantly, and that's the end of the show. So they do it a couple of different times because now it's not Tony Soprano, but it's, you know, somebody that's, you know, a black person in these roles, or Walter White is now Walter Black in the show and stuff like that, in the skit that he did. And it was really good because it was funny, but it also was like, yeah, because that's really true. You can only imagine these excuses for aberrance if they look like you, if you're a white person, which is a great example of Breaking Bad. That character becomes instantly, I would say to most of mainstream culture, you can't identify with him at all if he's not white. So
no. And I think that's shown when a lot of traditionally white characters are starting to be played by different people of color, in particular more black people. But say Idris Elba as James Bond, which has been rumored. People are throwing a fit.
Oh, my God. Look at Annie. Look at poor Corvenzine. Look at her. First of all, Annie was an amazing movie. I absolutely loved it. It was fantastic. I took all of my nieces and nephews to go see it. 14 of us went to the theater, and we loved it. But honestly, to see people like, oh, I can't believe they made Annie black. Like, and?
It's a fictional character.
It's just a cartoon. It's not that serious. And also, I was doing a little research, and it turned out Annie was actually made red-haired because at the time that the comic strip was written, it was supposed to help with anti-Irish sentiment. It was purposeful.
Oh.
So then, add that layer to it, like the character's meant to stop discrimination in its physicality. So, of course, an update should be a black person. Hello?
It's like these are not the same people who are – these people are not up in arms about Exodus.
No, of course not. Exodus is fine. Jesus had blonde hair, so they're good with that.
Jesus is – and all the people in Africa are white.
Mm-hmm.
Except the slaves.
Except them.
The slaves, yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
I actually had a discussion about like that movie in particular and the claim that at that point in time those would have been Middle Easterners or Semites. Even if that is absolutely the case, name me a Semite that looks like
Christian Bale. Not happening.
Yeah, name nope. name one that looks nope. like Christian Bale.
None
name
of them.
One. I'll
not
wait.
One. He's British. Nope.
Well, I mean, you know, and I think I would have been if you weren't, you know, if you were. Just don't make us. You just had to give, but you had. Did you have to give us the slave parts? Like, did you? Is that?
Of course they did. Well, I did want to mention one really great Tumblr, which is artistsagainstpoliceviolence.tumblr.com. You're able, if you are an artist and would like to submit a piece, you can submit it right there. There's a whole bunch of really great, amazing pieces and artists that have submitted things, including Patrick Campbell's New Age of Slavery, among other things. It's just the site itself is amazing. And if you are an artist, I would really suggest you go and check it out. There's no due date. It's rolling submissions. So as soon as you have your work and you want to get it seen along with these other artists, it's really great. Great site to check out. And I'll have the link to that as well. It's artistsagainstpoliceviolence.tumblr.com. So I think we are nearing the end of our little chat here. But Davey, why don't you tell us a little bit about where we can find you and a little bit about the company you run as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I run, or I'm a CEO of a DC Tutor LLC, and that's in DC. It's a Washington DC based company. And I do private instruction. I do SAT prep. I do college application process workshops. I do all that kind of stuff. But, so there's that. But, the other thing, I guess, which is also very, very similar to, you know, I guess, movement in some kind of way is the Free Your Soul and Mind movement, which is basically the tenets of that is to create your own path, discover what makes you happy and pursue it and reject the status quo. It's a community of individuals who are helping others to do the things that they love to do by doing the things that they love to do. So, you know, it's kind of a full circle. For that, we also have a philanthropic part of that. So we established an annual scholarship. It started last year in memory of one of my classmates. It's given to a student at Duke Ellington School of the Arts every year, that a creative thinker, and to help them with, you know, the costs of college. So to find that, or to really to find anything that I'm doing, if you go to www.davyceleste.com, everything is on there. You can also follow me on Instagram at Davy Celeste, or for the Free Your Soul and Mind or FISM movement, it's Activism, A-C-T-I, F as in Frank, Y, S as in Sam, M as in Mike.
Awesome. Cool. And we'll be sure to have all of those links as well on the show notes. David, did you have any final things you wanted to say? Kind of anything you wanted to add? Let the people know about?
No, actually, I have one last comment, I guess, that I would like to, you know, everybody, you know, there are multiple forms of activism. And I think that we all have to kind of find the one that we can best execute. For some, that'll be through their art. For some, that'll be through speaking or teaching. You know, there are lots of different ways to join the movement. You just have to find the one that best suits you and the one that you can best have a great effect on.
Awesome. Ricky, what's going on with you? When's the next AUA podcast going to be coming out?
Sherelle's back, so my depression is over, so Woo-hoo! I actually can work on stuff.
Welcome back, Sherelle.
Yeah. Davey, I'm glad you gave her back, because I was already miserable. Oh, my God.
You had the doggy.
I know, but, you know, even she was miserable.
You guys are both like, oh, she's not here.
Someone's missing. Yeah. So hopefully it should be done by the end of this week. I have an episode of AUA Hope to finish editing and an episode of the AUA podcast, because we took a small depression-related hiatus.
Got it.
And so, hopefully it should be out soon.
She's probably gathered a whole bunch of hope stories, too, I bet. I'm sure she's just chock full of them by now.
Yeah.
And just say again where everybody can follow you guys on Twitter and such.
Yeah, sure thing. You can find us at auamovement.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/auamovement. You can find us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter as AUADOTORG. And our podcasts are available on Stitcher and iTunes. You can go to auamovement.org/podcast and see where you can subscribe to each of the podcasts there. Outside of that, that's it. Don't call me. Don't text me. If I know you, then you're more than welcome to. But if I don't.
There you have it, people. Straight from Ricky. And you can find this show again on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, Ferguson Response Network. You can also find us online at FergusonResponse.org. I will finish up here, one, by thanking Davey for being here and Ricky for coming in and being my permanent co-host. I'm so excited. It's going
to
be awesome.
Oh, my. I mean, I always find more ways to put more work on my plate than I probably should, but this I enjoy. I'm gonna enjoy. So
I'm excited.
I don't care.
Well, thank you for saying yes. I appreciate it. And I saw a really cool kind of new thing for the new year, which is 29 ways to be a better activist. I'll have the link on the show notes, but I'll just go through a few of them. Act locally. Mm. Be open to anything. Update your opinions. Mm. Look at things through a child's eyes. Listen to what is not being said.
That's a key one. That's very key.
Very key. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Don't forget kindness and humility. You don't need to be right all the time. Mm. Be assertive. Be authentic. Question.
I have a thing though.
About
what if being authentic and being nice conflict?
I didn't say you had to be nice. I just said you had to not forget about kindness and humility.
Ah, yeah, fair enough.
They're not the same thing. You know, you can cannot be nice. That's okay, Ricky. It's okay. But I know you won't forget about kindness and humility. Be authentic. Question authority. Do something. Don't just talk about it. Believe in the future you can make. And number 29, never give up. Thanks so much for joining us and have a good night.